So welcome to Anurag Mahesh Verma podcast. This is a new episode that features insightful exploration about the recent ban on American reservation system, more commonly known as affirmative action plan in the United States of America. There is so much of confusion as well as curiosity about what exactly this affirmative plan was and why it got banned in the US. So to provide an insightful perspective on this, we have today our guest, Pallavi Rao, who will guide us through the intricacies of this decision, shedding light on the motives driving the elimination of diversity plans and affirmative actions. Pallavi Rao is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia in the United States. She teaches undergraduate courses on diversity and representation in the media, creative labor studies, and digital media culture. Her research looks at caste, class, and social networks in Indian media ownership. But before we embark on this discussion, I would like to humbly request your support. Crafting high-quality content that resonates with our listener required dedicated effort, time, and resources. So as an independent podcaster, I rely on the support of passionate listeners like you. So if you find value in my podcast and wish to contribute to its growth, then please do consider becoming a patron on Patreon or making a donation through convenient platforms like PayPal, Buy Me a Coffee, or InstaMojo. Now, in fact, I also have my UPI ID mentioned in the description box. So please make sure to check them and contribute so that this podcast can survive and I can bring you more insightful discussion in the future. So now, without wasting any time, let's start the episode number 69 of Anurag Mahesh Verma podcast. So Pallavi, let's discuss this thing step by step. Main question about scrapping of affirmative action policies that many people are in India are confused that there was even a reservation to begin with in US, because most of the people in India think that US is superpower because there is no reservation and we Indian are backward nation because there is a reservation. So
yes.
Are there reservations in US and what kind of quota and reservation exist in US?
So it's not called reservation for a couple of reasons. There used to be what are called racial quotas in admissions. And for a very long time, it's funny because pre-civil rights, those quotas were very small to limit the number of non-white and particularly black students on campus. So they could not take in, say, more than 5 black students in every undergraduate program that, you know, was available at that time. So they used to use it to limit the number of students they had. After civil rights, and particularly through some key legal cases from the 70s, they basically expanded those, but they still had numerical quotas until 1978, where the Supreme Court had an actual judgment against the University of California, which then said that they will no longer allow racial quotas. So specific number of seats, for instance, would not be set aside, but that racial identity could be one of several factors in college admission policy. So that significantly changed the numerical, reservation. So they no longer call it reservation. They just call it affirmative action, because part of it is to say that when somebody's application is being evaluated, if they're from a racial minority group, we will factor that in as something in their favor, generally. The problem is that American admissions committees and the process are very opaque. They're not like India, where you have clear cutoff points. They'll give you ranges for the SAT scores, for instance, like the GRE for grad school also and so on. So what they have is a series of considerations they take when they're admitting students in. One of which is racial identity. They have personal essays in these applications. I've done these extracurricular activities. I've taken leadership positions in these groups, blah, blah, blah. And you come out of certain elite high schools where there are lots of, say, sports programs or scholarship programs. So all of those things are what you'd self-describe in these essays, along with certain, you know, bare minimum GPA and all that you enter. And then you mention, you declare your racial identity and you talk about it in your essays. And that is one of the ways in which they could consider it. How often they do, how consistently they do, is a big question mark. right? Because this is almost always down to individual admission committees, and what they decide is, you know, more egalitarian in that particular year, and so on and so forth. And of course, cultural discourse very much affects what those people think also, or as equity or diversity. So what has increasingly happened is that as much as affirmative action was used by certain schools, in some other states, I think 9 other states before this judgment had already banned affirmative action. University of California was one of them. And the University of California actually has documented records on the fact that when the state banned affirmative action, their enrollment of Black and Hispanic students literally plummeted. It went down to half in the next couple of years. And then over the years, they have had to do a lot of outreach in terms of DEI, invest money, billions of dollars, I think $500 million actually, into DEI initiatives, so that now UCLA and the UC system, University of California system in particular, has some diversity because of the money they have personally had to put into it. So what affirmative action had normatively done before, the university is having to do outreach and actually, you know, work really hard to increase participation of Black and Hispanic students in their programs and so on. So this is, you know, a huge part of why affirmative action, even the discourse of it matters, because it's been very detrimental when it's been banned for the admission of minorities into many of these big state schools in particular. These are residential universities, right? So Berkeley, UCLA, and all of that, and University of California, for instance, is a huge one. And of course, the elite Ivy Leagues are also an extension of that. So yeah, so reservation, like in the Indian context, does not exist, right? Because in India, you get a very clear sense of what cutoff rates are, how many students get admitted. And one problem with the transparency is that these students are permanently stuck with that identity. They're targeted with that identity. But the fact is, you know that the person has in fact benefited from reservation and is in the college because, you know, there is that they've used the certificate and so on and so forth. So there's a little bit of transparency and therefore accountability as a result of that. Okay, tumne kitne logon ko admit kiya reservation ke through and kon-kon matlab aaye hain. But also that is a double-edged sword, I think. But in India, it's very clear that this is constitutionally mandated number of seats, percentage of, you know, the total seats goes to different groups and so on and so forth. So India ka thoda transparent hai abhi bhi. America is much more opaque.
Is it because India, this is a constitutional thing? It is mentioned in the constitution, yes. And as compared to the US, which is more of an executive thing, I guess.
Yes, very much. Executive. And then the problem also is a lot of these universities have designed admission systems to be complicated in this way, right? It's not just ek entrance test and uska mark se tum andar jaoge. They have all these interview processes sometimes. They bring these undergrad students to have campus tours. So there's all sorts of ways in which they're gauging student suitability to the program and things like that. I mean, many students treat it like a job interview almost, because they have to write these very, you know, the essays are now kind of one of those hamare aaj jaise entrance exam ke liye hum log tuition lete hain. They have these, you know, companies and consultants who help with writing college essays, because that really can be a very huge determining factor. But the essays are very subjective. So this is really the problem in some ways, because, you know, you never know who the, if you do see suddenly you have many students of color in your class, several of them are Black, the assumption that all of them have gotten into affirmative action is a little hard to claim outright. Because you don't know, some of them have excellent grades. They may have, you know, gotten ticked all the boxes that Harvard and so on are putting there. And some of them may just come from generally middle-class families that do have the resources to also afford that. On the other hand, some of them are, you know, benefiting from affirmative action. How do you know who is benefiting and who's not? So there's a lot of, again, assumptions guiding this, right? And I think particularly this current moment where there's so much pushback against anti-racism, there's so much resurgence of, you know, this idea of some neutral, race-neutral, race-objective ideas of equality, the idea that DEI is going too far and all of that. It's huge right now in the college campuses, right? The way it's being discussed. So I think this backlash is also coming from that, you know, the current cultural moment. Because for a very long time, at least, there was an agreement that things are bad. You know, we're not getting there's a category of actual universities here called PWI, which is predominantly white institutions. And that is how the university self-described, when over 80 to, I think, anything above 85% is considered PWI. So it's, you know, the university itself acknowledges that, yes, this is not a representative, you know, student body. These are, in fact, predominantly white institutions where white students tend to be the dominant group. So when they admitted themselves, then they have to also, you know, go out of their way to show that they're trying to recruit non-white students. So yeah. And this is also why you have HBCUs, right? Because the historically black universities came as a result of this continuing inequality. And of course, because affirmative action was constantly being battled. So the black students and black community members created their own historically black universities. Howard University is one of those, for instance. So segregation created that dynamic where, you know, black universities had to come up as a way of countering the elitism of many of these PWIs.
Mm. It's very interesting because when I visited to that University of Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia.
I saw your video. I think you had shared it. Yeah.
So there was many statues of black people. So there I asked my friend, "Ki itni jada statue kyun hai yahan pe?" So he said that whenever there is a protest or Black Lives Matter ka koi bhi protest hota hai, they demand for more student, to wo ek statue bana dete hain. Now, thing is that there are more statue in the campus than the black student.
Yeah.
So, but surprised. in these Ivy League, at least these top institution of the US. So, what kind of diversity is there? Is there some kind of diversity? Like, there are more black students? How is it?
So, in many ways, it is the DEI initiatives, at least in the recent past, have been the ways in which the universities tend to address this gap. Sometimes you see a sudden influx of scholarships, so there are various ways in which they target black students, undergrads in particular, and graduate students as well. But affirmative action is one of the things that during the admissions processes was very much acknowledged as being a tool that, you know, the Harvards and the Yales could use to address the gap. That is one of the reasons why Harvard was targeted, right, in this lawsuit, because Harvard being the sort of elite bastion that it is, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, the people want a stake in that. So they'll target the most elite universities for this reason, is because it is, those are, you know, somewhat life-changing for people who can get in. So there have been affirmative action measures that have actually been very actively in use in several of these Ivies. But of course, the Asian American backlash has been that they felt like their numbers have dropped. And there's probably some truth to this, in the sense that if you are from a group that has higher income and going to the good schools and has not does not have the kind of historical discrimination that, say, black students have faced, they're sidelined. So some of the grievances, in the sense that, the Asian American students are the ones sort of hurt by this, it's probably not completely inaccurate. But of course, the question is, does everybody want, if everybody wanted a Harvard degree, do we all fight, you know, how Harvard decides what social justice is? And of course, the fact that affirmative action primarily benefits black students, is that what you want your fight to be, right? I think is the question here. Because what is your idea of equality? And how do you understand, you know, what you're demanding if you say end affirmative action? Because ultimately, you are benefiting the same privileged white groups that have always dominated Harvard, right? And we want to actually still, be considered neutral or whatever it is. There is no race neutral category. If you reject affirmative action on the basis of race, then you're basically normalizing white racism, right? That they are the ones who end up being, white privilege gets normalized. So that logic has not sunk into some of these other groups in the Middle, Asian Americans, Indian Americans also included, though I will say Indian Americans are not predominantly against affirmative action. A few people have very vocally participated in this case, which I think is worth highlighting as well.
It's very interesting because when I visited to Ashoka University, I made a video that it's a Harvard of Haryana, but now Harvard has become Ashoka University of US because there is also no reservation. So that's quite an interesting thing. Although the main question, although you briefly said in the last bit, but who are the people who are against affirmative action? I don't know what are the ways in which the law operates. Matlab koi to gaya hoga court mein to get it quashed. So who are these people and what are their arguments?
Yes. So the there is a group called Students for Fair Action, if I'm correct. SFFA is the acronym. It was started by predominantly white people. In fact, that guy Ed Blum, I think, is the one who's created the group itself. And for a very long time, they were the ones, advocating for, banning affirmative action. But I think they got a tremendous amount of support from Asian American groups, some of which are Chinese American and Chinese Canadian, if I'm correct. One of the guys, Calvin Yang, who spoke up very much in public, is Canadian and wanted a Harvard admission. So in some ways, it's interesting that who decides or who is becoming interested or invested in the
small interruption. Sorry. I just wanted to know that don't the Asian American also get some kind of quota for like people of color or people who, they are also in the minority. So don't they get something in this?
When we say affirmative action, when Asian students mention their own race in these application materials, those are also factored in very much, in fact, so these are not, completely discounted or anything like that. But it seems much more obvious that when people say affirmative action, the primary beneficiaries are Black students. So what has happened is because of the influx of Asian Americans who actually, the number of applications they get from Asian Americans is huge, as you can imagine, because many of them are middle class, upper middle class migrants to the US who are based on the West Coast, for instance, and for the UC system, most of them are based in California. So one of the reasons California has been a hotbed of these legal cases has been, especially in the past, has been because it's, Asian Americans who have felt very much like as they populate the state and as there are huge numbers coming in and as their kids aspire to get an elite education, that they get sidelined in the process. So in terms of sheer volume of applications and the number of admits, it is possible that there's a disparity there that Asian Americans do get hampered by this, right? But again, this is Harvard. So it's like Harvard does not guarantee admission to everyone. It's not even a public school. None of the Ivies are government public funded. They're in fact private research institutions. So, what is this pie that you want to share it, right? It is the most elite pie in America. Your entire set of networks that you have, the status of your CV, all of that is built through this elite Ivy League education. And they are elitists because they're exclusivists. They are because, they're very good, selective about who they apply. So that very selectivism is what you aspire to rather than, a democratic, publicly funded education, right? So Asian Americans seeking this is very typical to our class aspirations within the US as well. Very much wanting to enter the white upper middle class that has made so much of the wealth on the West and the East Coast. So I think that those racial and class dynamics are huge here and how these Asian Americans, particularly middle and upper class Asian Americans, have been a huge part of this. And yes, of course, many of them actually testified in Congress and was it the Supreme Court is what I'm wondering. Because I remember there was a panel, Asha Jadeja Motwani is one of those diasporic Indians who has been very vocally anti-affirmative action. She's a venture capitalist in San Francisco and I think also based in New York.
Yeah, I know,
So
on
in some
Twitter,
way,
I've seen
she's...
That.
Exactly. So she's one of the people who I remember who had spoken up very vocally that, this all of this stuff on race and racism is very antithetical to American democracy. And again, it's this very privileged, blind idea of what race racism are. The idea, for instance, that Indians are not discriminated as much because they're protected, because they're good migrants, right? That is the constant logic here, the model minority sentiment. That is what they advocate. And there is, in many ways, the fact that they'll acknowledge that inequality exists, but also they very much feel like America is a meritocracy and America will reward them if they are, in fact, meritocratic enough. They do the right things, check all the boxes and so on. And so affirmative action for them stands in the way of that.
Also because even in the homeland, they oppose the reservation so much so that they, I think they hate the whole idea of the R word, which is very offensive.
I think what's interesting is that in some of India's best colleges, at least even now, I will say, are the public universities, right? It's the JNUs, the DUs, Jadavpur, the IITs, the IIMs. These are the highest quality education you can get in India. So there is the sense of resentment there, which is that, we are being deprived of our Janam Sidh Adhikar to get admission into these colleges. So I think what's interesting is for me, the Ivy League versus the, you know, public university debate. In the US, public universities are considered perhaps less favorable than getting into an Ivy. So in some ways, you know, I'm very struck by the fact that idhar pe aake tumko public university nahi chahiye, because it is actually diverse. And I will say this, Anurag, there are also many different kinds of public universities in the US. You have the residential colleges such as University of California, University of Michigan, which are not Ivies necessarily, but they're big research-oriented state schools. But you also have state universities like SUNY, SUNY is one of them, CUNY is one of them. And in UC, in California, you have the California State University System, CSUs. These are non-residential. This is predominantly where the working class and lower middle class folks send their kids to for a college education. They're a little more community college style in terms of what they actually educate you in, which is not these large liberal arts programs, but much more professional programs, programs that seek to, you know, place people into actual jobs. And they're very, about one third of all undergraduates in the US, if I'm correct from the last statistic I saw, go to these state universities, which are not the big, you know, affirmative action dominated programs in like UC's, University of Michigan, or those big centralized schools where there are residences and, you know, dorms, and the whole the quote unquote college experience is such a big part of why you go to those schools and go into debt to actually get your undergrad degree, right? So the idea of prestige is staggered in this way, I think, which is interesting. And again, the fact that Indian Americans and Asian Americans in general predominantly want to get an Ivy League education. They want their Princeton, Yale, Harvard degrees, right? So the fact that they want that exclusivist education means that they're already saying, humko public education nahi chahiye. We want entry into this elite crowd. Whereas in India, it's like, nahi, but because these are the best in India, we want entry into that, you know, and we want, you know, complete like normative waving off of all reservations. So only the marks and the cutoff ranges and all of that are the only things that need to be considered when we actually get admission. Even interviews and all that are, should not be using caste as a metric or gender as a metric to be considered when you're admitting students in.
But in general, is there a conversation around affirmative action in the US, like the negative, like the heavily negative conversation around affirmative action like it is in India among a certain section of people? Like, can there be compared? Because I saw a tweet by Tulsi Gabbard.
Yes.
She said that it's a victory of racial justice. Now nobody will be discriminated on the basis of race. So,
it's of quite course. I mean, I think amongst the conservatives, there certainly is this discourse. I will say that perhaps until there's been a very huge shift in how racial discourse in the US was would allow this certain things to be said since Obama's victory, right? I feel like one of the interesting things that when Obama became president, one of the things that happened is everyone started acting as if America was now post-racial. We have a black president. What more do we need, right? We have achieved equality.
Like, just like in India, they say that you have the women as president.
Draupadi Murmu is now a president. We don't need reservation, right? So once that discursive shift happened, right, in the Obama time, then it became very okay to say that black people are not as struggling as much. Though there are literal statistics that constantly show this wrong, right? Like, there, if you literally look at the numbers, enrollments into these elite programs, they drop. Many of these departments remain predominantly white. There are horrible instances of racism on campus. Campus police themselves are very racist against black students and commit brutality against black students on campus. So, and of course, BLM has soared since 2014 in particular, right? Since Ferguson. So on the one hand, you have this cultural moment where Black Lives Matter takes off. And on the other hand, you have a conservative discourse that says, no, but you have Obama. Why do you keep saying racism, racism? Right. So that, I think, has really sort of galvanized an anti-affirmative action crowd, which definitely feels like it's time to say that, you know, bahut zyada anti-racism ho gaya. Itna nahi chahiye. You know, we've done enough. We've acknowledged some, you know, historical wrongs. But now sab cheez mein tum log anti-racism laoge, you're then attacking meritocracy and yahan pe, you know, the capitalism ka logic and all of that stuff, the great American, the American dream and how it's being taken away from more worthy people and all of that nonsense starts circulating. So I feel like the Obama presidency is a shift where you see certain ideas of, you know, we can't do too much anti-racism now and racism is gone, is really becoming normal. And that is where a lot of these politicians start getting on board, public figures start getting on board. Till then, it was very much still considered like this fringe white group that's asking to remove affirmative action. So I think there's a lot of tension, which is there is some public sentiment now where you recognize that racism is still quite terrible. But on the other hand, the pushback from the conservatives is like, no, it's not. You had Obama, you have Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court, you have all these black figures, celebrities who've become very famous. So in some ways, you know, you have Beyonce, you have whatever, all these ludicrous ideas that one celebrity has undone all the inequality, you know, that logic becomes more common sense by then.
But it's also interesting that in US, there's all this cultural war and social justice thing is on the increase, on the rise, as we see from the distance, like people on the streets, BLM movement and everything. But on the other hand, the court is giving verdicts like abortion is banned, reservation is banned. So what is this disparity? And some people are also saying, some of my American friends, it's because of the Trump. So Trump bechare ne abhi kya kiya iske andar, Supreme Court ka, how he changed.
Trump ne teen justice laga diya. That he has done his job. This is all the Republicans, I think, in many ways wanted. And they wanted Trump to be there to do that.
But because is it possible to put Supreme Court judges wahan pe by a president?
So the president is the person who officially nominates, comes with all sorts of recommendations from party members. But it is the job of the president to put them up for nomination. And of course, one chief justice died, I forget his name, in Obama's time, and his very last year. And so at that point, this is a mistake that Obama made, in that he nominated Merrick Garland. But because it was an election year coming up, the Republicans lobbied very hard against that nomination. And they said, you're trying to push this through before the next election, so we will not vote on this. And this was very clearly partisan. This was very clearly with a political agenda. These appointments are usually not ideological in the sense most people agree that if you nominate a judge, the primary thing you should see is if they're qualified to actually, you know, if they have enough judicial experience and they've demonstrated the right amount of constitutional knowledge, you primarily then the Congress, there's a judicial committee or whatever that is that interviews these nominations, ask them the difficult questions about what is your position on this, how do you justify a ruling on this, and so on and so forth. So it's like a job interview for the most part, just looking at the reasoning and the rationale that these judges have used. For the first time in the Merrick Garland nomination, they refused to hold those hearings and said that no, you are pushing this through at a very last minute, you know, or last stages of your presidency, and it's not correct. And of course, the moment Trump comes in, he starts nominating these very conservative judges. You know, the fellow who was accused of rape, I'm forgetting his name. Brett Kavanaugh, yes. When Brett Kavanaugh was nominated, one of his old high school classmates basically accused him of attempted rape. And so that was one of his first nominations. Neil Gorsuch was the other one, Gorsuch or whatever how you pronounce it. And then Amy Coney Barrett, who literally belongs to some sort of really conservative Catholic cult. And as these, some of these are, you know, constitutional literalists. Matlab, wo jo constitution mein jo likha hai, usko purely literal interpretation uska karte hain. Which means if something is not explicitly included in constitutional wording, they will not agree that it is actually applicable. So in many ways, this is these are some of the most conservative judges you will ever find in a court even, right? They are very sort of harsh of the punishments, the judgments that they give, the convictions that they give, and so on. So these three were all nominated by Trump because Stephen Breyer, I think, was the one who resigned when Obama was supposed to nominate somebody. Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, and somebody else recently also resigned as a result. So three justices resigned during the Trump presidency, which made the Trump nominees to the Supreme Court, all conservative ones, flip the Supreme Court in an ideological direction entirely towards conservatives. Before that, it was 5-4, and at least two of them were quite moderate, so they were not so hardcore conservative. So this conservative shift, and when he was nominating them itself, all of these were actually questioned on whether or not they will overturn Roe v. Wade. And they all lied and said they won't. They said that is already constitutionally decided in the 70s. We do not want to go back and revisit Roe v. Wade. They actually said that under oath. And then they actually passed and rolled back Roe v. Wade while they actually got nominated. So, you know, this is very classic Republican tactics. They play dirty. They're okay lying. or they're okay saying that, you know, we have reconsidered our position and whatever and gone back. Whereas the Democrats have tried to play fair, which I think in this context is important to say it didn't work for them. They were obviously foolish to think that this wouldn't happen. So it's because the agenda here is when, and there's a great article actually that's come out on Clarence Thomas and his particular brand of conservatism as a black person, right? And as someone who used to be a Black Panther, he has swung from the extreme left. Yeah, he has swung from the extreme left to extreme right. He has a wife also who's fairly white supremacist in all of her political views, but married to a black man. So, you know, the legitimacy, sab kuch, you know, it's like having the... usko wo villain ban gaya hai. You know, he has entered the villain era, as we say. And it's astonishing. So there is a lot of now writing on Clarence Thomas and his particular position there.
Is it the same guy who went to Yale University through affirmative action?
Yes, and he actually says that affirmative action made me a target for the white supremacists. Sab log ne mujhe affirmative action admit karke insult kiya. To us din se mujhe affirmative action mein ke saath I am anti affirmative action because I think it makes, in a way, it's this perverse idea ki because you are told that you are an affirmative action admit, you are not good enough. The Supreme Court, despite the cultural moment that we're in, because it has now been populated with many of these conservatives, I think they've honestly not cared about what the cultural discourse is at this point. Their entire agenda has been to jump straight into pushing forth conservative positions. And the logic that they often use is that these laws are now the purview of the states. And particularly because there are, of course, many states that are dominated by conservative politics, particularly in the South, that those states should get to make their own laws on things like abortion, affirmative action, and so on and so forth. So in Roe v. Wade, for instance, that's the logic that they had for that judgment, which is this should not be the Supreme Court's decision. It should actually go through the states themselves and they should decide. Which, of course, you know, electoral politics in the U.S. is so driven by very wealthy lobbyists and political groups that conservatives can really, you know, push hard to pass their own positions on these things. They can be anti-abortion and, you know, so many of these states have since passed extremely restrictive abortion laws, you know, even saying things like rape victims cannot get abortions, women in very difficult pregnancies that can endanger their life can be denied abortion. I mean, these are medically negligent practices, if you ask me, because even in some of the more conservative countries, these are exceptions to the abortion clauses. So in many ways, that very harsh kind of, you know, very inconsiderate and very cruel, if you ask me, conservative politics, where you don't consider the individual circumstances of each case, and you simply want a blanket ban on abortion, has become the norm in several states now. So the conservative, you know, tilt is it passes in the guise of, no, we're letting the states make their own laws, but it's been to the detriment of several, you know, women and other people who get pregnant in that state. And I think it's also important to ask, what is the Supreme Court then? One of the reasons these judgments went to the courts back in the day is because the Supreme Court could override conservative states and their choices and assure Americans wherever they live that this law will no longer apply, like will be the overarching law now, regardless of where you live. So even if you are a person living in Tennessee or Mississippi or whatever, smaller states or more conservative states, you will be affected in no way by the fact that the state is conservative if you want to access things like affirmative action or in the case of abortion in particular, right? So now that they have, again, kind of decentralized this and said the states can handle this, it basically means the state that you live in can have a huge say, right, in whether or not you have certain rights guaranteed to you. And that's, in many ways, it fractures the country in specific ways, and it strengthens conservative politics in these huge pockets, which benefits them when the presidential elections come around. So yeah, it's a lot of calculated, you know, it's the people who do electoral planning, even in India, do these caste equations, right? It's very much looking in similar ways at racial equations, class equations in the US, and that's what the court is now favoring, it looks like.
But and there are huge protests when something like this happened. For example, this abortion law is so anti-women, anti-human, in fact.
Yes.
So aren't there civil society or even the general public, don't they protest and, you know, come against these kind of law?
But I also think somewhere in the US, there is, barring the Black Lives Matter movement, at least in the recent past, the kind of large-scale taking to the streets and not leaving and willing to just stay there and face whatever police violence and all of that has not happened in every single instance of these, right? For instance, I would like to, I attended, the protest that came out right in the wake of that Roe v. Wade ruling in my own town, which is Charlottesville, Virginia. Many of them were second wave feminists from organizations like National Organization of Women, NOW. It's considered to be a very liberal feminist organization. It's had its accusations of white feminism and so on, but they were there. But what was frustrating is a lot of it then again comes back to talk to your local politician, talk to your local member of Congress, talk to your local senator, you know. And so it again comes back with the onus on reaching out to politicians within the system. And that is a very slow process of change. In fact, these movements have been done to death in the 60s and 70s for a reason, right? That was when they pushed these politicians to actually take action and actually protect women's rights in all these ways. Now you're seeing that we're having to redo all of this with an entirely new generation of politicians, right? Who are, in fact, again, thinking about their political career. Many in the Democrat Party, you know, there's a party establishment you have to consider when you're going to get reelected. Are you going to be the candidate running? Do you get money to support your campaigns? All of the internal party politics starts becoming a consideration. And there's a lot of transactional ideas of, okay, I will push abortion rights, but at the cost of not pushing something else, right? So that whole political, lobbying and quid pro quo kind of attitude really takes charge. So to me, it's frustrating because I'm a little bit like, we should actually have angry protests that say we will not leave until you reverse this. This is not acceptable to us. But it's not like that. It's very much in this liberal democratic mode of we will contact our politicians, call your local senator. And I'm not even a citizen here. So for me, I'm a little bit frustrated because I'm like, you know, what are my rights here while I live in the US as a temporary resident to actually push and demand these things? Because the local politics is going to take years to unfold, right? If you go to your congressperson, they have to take it to Congress. They need a president in power who will pass it. All of these conditions constantly keep changing. It looks likely that, you know, Republicans are going to push Trump again in 2024, for instance. What if he wins again, right? These are all like huge questions that will impact how these laws can even be overturned. The idea that everyone has said that should work is that Congress itself now passes something like Roe v. Wade through the Congress and Senate and actually enshrines it in the Constitution. So the Supreme Court cannot override the Constitution, right? But of course, how do you get something through a Senate that is controlled by Republicans like Mitch McConnell, who won't let something like that pass? So there's a lot of opposition and lobbying that they have to do there. It's an uphill process and a very slow process. So, you know, it's easy to undo history. It's very difficult to redo history. Like that.
That's true.
Yeah. So that's very much the case with Roe v. Wade and possibly with affirmative action as well.
But how would the universities or other groups going to react to this kind of decision? Because I've seen Obama has criticized it. Even Joe Biden has also criticized it. Even Harvard has said that we will use the loophole to get the admission through the race, which is quite different than, let's say, agar India ke andar they ban reservation, then
yes,
most of the
yes,
top university ke jitne bhi Sharma ji aur Mukherjee hain, wo to laddu waddu baatenge aur kaafi khush honge.
Bilkul.
So Harvard is saying that we will use the loophole in the system to get more black students. So
yeah.
why that kind of thing is happening, and what kind of future protest can you see?
Well, the thing that I think they are going to invest a lot more money on is DEI initiatives, right? And diversity, equity, and inclusion opportunities. And there are many ways in which these universities do that. You'll see that, for instance, university that I'm in has a lot of scholarships and fellowships supporting students of color, particularly black students. University of Virginia, where I am, was actually built by slaves. You know, it was Thomas Jefferson's university, and it was his idea, and he actually lived on the campus for a while at the time that he owned slaves. So the university is doing a lot of outreach to the black community within and around Charlottesville, and also addressing, you know, the fact that they are a predominantly white institution. And how can they diversify? So many of these come from diligent black and other the sorts of people in management who can direct funds in specific ways and so on. But of course, these are all, institutionally driven initiatives. They're not mandated by law. So tomorrow, you know, if, for instance, even within my own state right now, there's a huge push by the conservative governor of the state to put a lot of conservative people in the board of trustees. So tomorrow, if the board of trustees decides that they don't want to devote as much money to DEI, which is already a conversation that we are aware of in within the academic administrators, you will see that that money can just disappear overnight. And because it is not constitutionally guaranteed or legally, you know, mandated, where do students cannot protest it, because it is literally coming out of the largest of the university, and they're, you know, they have these big endowments. If they decide to direct that money elsewhere, right, you can't protest, you can't write all these letters, you can't go to your local congressman also, because they will say, well, the university can decide what it wants to do with its money. So in many ways, these mine is still a public institution, so there could be some accountability still. But in places like Harvard and Yale, for instance, if they decide suddenly that they don't want to do diversity initiatives, then there is no way to hold them accountable, right? So I admire the fact that Harvard put out that statement very promptly and said that we will still consider racial identity in these individual essays and when students particularly talk about things like hardship. But we also know then that it is in many ways standardizing and streamlining a kind of oppression essay. You know, there is a template that people will follow now. Ki agar tumne bola ki mujhe racial oppression hua hai and I have suffered in these ways, which of course non-black people can exploit as much as any other group. You will see a certain kind of college essay become the norm. Which is already the case also, I will say this, that many people already complain that diversity is a buzzword and people talk about oppression Olympics and oppression politics now in these very banal ways and these essays. But I think it's just going to make that the new normal and just be like, okay, now if you have a racial identity and you want to talk about being a minority, this is how you use this language, this is how you talk. And like a lot of DEI initiatives, it can end up being very superficial signaling, right? It will likely benefit that whole, you know, the creamy layer type argument will come up as well. It will very much be like, oh, jo already middle class hai, wo zyada benefit karenge. And this is a question for them within the larger university itself about class politics, because Harvard is so elite that, you know, the question of whether a working class person or a lower middle class person can get in is actually almost laughable, because many people say it's not going to happen. And when the discourse itself is so heavily anti-inclusion and anti-diversity, then students are not even tempted to apply. This is the other thing that many people, the University of California president actually pointed this out in one of his interview responses that I saw. He said that the detrimental effect also happens twofold, not just at the level of, okay, we can no longer consider race in admissions. It comes from the student itself who hears all of these people talking about affirmative action as this terrible thing and decides that, no, I'm probably not going to get an admission to this university because it's predominantly white. They want students from good colleges who have all of these things on their CV and I don't have that, so I should not even try to apply, right? And that is where that the discourse can really be harmful, which is that it basically makes students think that they're never going to be good enough to get into a University of Michigan or a University of California or even one of the Ivies, you know, which of course is very often anyway out of the reach of most college students in the US. I think that is something of a huge consideration here, which I think a lot of activists have pointed out.
Even when a person who is not from that kind of class or that kind of elite circle goes into these kind of university, then that alienation itself is a form of suffering, I would say. Because you can't match to that their aesthetics and their, you know, aspiration and their vocabulary.
Yes. I mean, I think Professor Avikant Kisana's recent article on, you know, the cultural capital of Savarnas, right? And how a Bahujan student can feel alienated just from, you know, being constantly subjected to certain kinds of Americanized discourses, exposure to Western culture. Those everyday forms of alienation and exclusion are huge, right? So how do you counter that? That is a huge question mark, even in the US, I think. But also, I think what's interesting and worth thinking about here is the fact that even getting into an Ivy League like school, very often, as much as affirmative action or even say scholarships that are in favor of DEI can support you, it takes a lot of investment materially and culturally to put yourself through 4 years of college there, right? It costs money to, for instance, to socialize in these colleges, because so much of what quote-unquote the college experience in the US involves are things like, you know, joining a fraternity or a sorority, being part of the party culture there, networking amongst these many groups. groups, because there are so many alumni who come and who are highly placed in, you know, corporates or in the government. There's a whole kind of sort of educational social capital that you have to gain. And the only way you can do that is by spending money, like in very material ways. Like I'm thinking even of, say, you know, dressing a particular way, for instance, or, you know, having certain ways to signal that you have some wealth, or you're willing to invest your time and effort in getting certain kinds of wealth, hobnobbing with elites in certain ways, talking about certain things, politics in certain ways, and with a certain sort of agenda or a certain orientation. These are all things that they're going to have to learn and pick up. And that is in itself a huge uphill task for many students who are not from those class groups or from those certain racial groups as well. Though increasingly we can see a small sort of, say, Asian American elite that can do this as well as the white people do, right? So there's a certain kind of elite culture it is grooming you for, and that you will hopefully benefit from in terms of, you know, opportunities and so on, that that really makes these universities appealing, particularly the Ivies, I will say. And that's what people are drawn towards. So I think that larger sort of the gap in terms of social and cultural capital is something that can hit students very hard as well, even as affirmative action measures are trying to target it and so on. How do you make sure that students are not excluded and, you know, felt very sort of alienated in these elite settings? It's honestly a very hard question to answer, because even in my universities, these are some of the questions that we struggle with when students don't talk in class, and you can see that their work is not of the same standard, and they don't seem to have a community, right, that they're a part of and that they can chat with and get some help from. So I think that those concerns are huge question marks, and they're not often discussed as also side consequences of banning affirmative action or limiting it, or, you know, when the discourse shifts into this very conservative vein, what do these students have to hear? What do they face? Because in the Indian context, we know what kinds of, you know, derogatory remarks they've had to face and how they've had to struggle against even making friends or keeping, you know, their identity as a sort of very private and something that they are proud of and they are recognized as their roots, you know, that becomes something itself that harms you. So, yeah, it's a very difficult situation.
In fact, I was watching a video, I think that was a TikTok video of some black student, and they were saying that because when they entered the college, they were told that they are here just because of affirmative action, and that they had various kind of inferiority complex during the whole time, thought that they are not deserving, they are not wanted in this campus and everything.
Yes.
So that conversation seemed very close to how it happens in the India. So anyways, my final question is that there are many Savarnas who are celebrating this decision and saying that since now US has banned this form of reservation, so now the next step should be that India should also ban it, and they are rejoicing. So although in India everybody have reservation now, even the upper caste have it in the form of EWS. So I don't know why they are celebrating or crying because of that. So do you think that conversation might also shift to the Indian context, in the Indian university, of rethinking, if not banning the reservation?
I think it would face huge backlash in India, because in terms of just public sector employment, public sector education, public universities, reservation has been a game changer, right? In the past three decades, in terms of just seeing visibly Dalit and Bahujan people in public spaces, and those who have been able to enter somewhat more of a middle class lifestyle in India. So I think that the pushback against that would be huge. I don't think this current government is quite ready to do that yet, which is one of the reasons I think EWS is more important for them to signal to their, you know, Brahmin Savarna voter base that they will still get some, you know, some piece of the pie. They can be guaranteed. But it's very clear that they're hesitant to touch reservation as of now, even though there's an urban middle class that's very Savarna and that is very sort of gleeful about the fact that, you know, the affirmative action debate can maybe spur anti-reservation debates in India. But I think the real viciousness of the anti-reservation crowd was exhibited already during the Mandal movement, right? The Mandal protests against reservation way back in the 90s. Some of the most horrible things that had to be said were said at that time. And while it generated a lot of sort of middle class sympathy, I think the fact that the successive governments have stuck to their guns, however, you know, half-heartedly or whatever, I think suggests that maybe there is nothing new to push back against reservations because it is guaranteed by the constitutions. I think at the most part, it's still at least in on paper, I think a little bit safer. And we don't have a Supreme Court to overturn this, right? Unlike in the US. So I think for the current Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha to pass this itself, it's going to have to, you know, be aware that, you know, certain, whether it's BSP or SP and all these other groups which already benefit from certain kinds of reservation will push back heavily against it. So that is there. They are capable of pushing back and, you know, overriding all these objections. I don't put it past them. But I feel like this is far less of a priority right now than, say, something like UCC, which is starting to, the Uniform Civil Code, that is starting to become the conversation. So I feel like the anti-reservation thing is a little bit, and they also want to play caste equations, right? So I feel like it's a bit dicey for them to try something that actually tries to stop reservation. They are doing a much more effective job in just not fulfilling reservation criteria. That is very, very obvious in many of these universities. OBC quotas are just not filled. SC/ST seats are just not filled, even in hiring and recruitment as well as in student admissions. So I think by just making reservation ineffective, they have actually harmed it much more than, say, outright banning it. Which in India, I think, is always is one of our tragedies. It's that, you know, but we are far less efficient than we are actually malicious. But the end result is the same, right? That exclusion, casteism, sexism, all that becomes the norm because nobody has the willpower to actually execute what is actually being mandated and what they should be doing.
Yeah, because I think in 2014 or 13, Subramaniam Swamy was in Jodhpur and some reporter asked him ki BJP government ka reservation ko khatam karegi. Then he made a very interesting statement ki BJP ya phir hamari jo government hai wo reservation ko to khatam nahi karegi but hum reservation ko halat mein la denge ki wo reservation ka hona hi ineffective ho jayega, which is the case which has been in the last many years because there are no vacancy jo hai government ki ya job ki vacancy wo aati nahi hai. So basically 98% if I'm not wrong jyadatar वो या तो कॉरपोरेट में या अनऑर्गेनाइज सेक्टर में सारी जॉब्स ही वहीं पर ही हैं जहाँ पर रिजर्वेशन नहीं है. शायद 2-3% कुछ है जो गवर्नमेंट जॉब है जिसके अंदर थोड़ा बहुत रिजर्वेशन है, वो भी बहुत सारी जगहों पे तो इनइफेक्टिव है.
यस,
तो
रियल क्वेश्चन इज प्राइवेट सेक्टर, राइट? आई थिंक दैट इज दैट हैज बीन द पुशबैक फॉर अ वेरी लॉन्ग टाइम बिकॉज दे हैव रिफ्यूज्ड एनी पॉसिबिलिटी दैट देयर विल बी that they can pass something in the Lok Sabha and Rajya Sabha and push some article through that can actually make reservations in private companies the norm because wahan pe to representation hai hi nahi, we know that. And that is the big question that I wonder if this current government is receptive to. I highly doubt it because I don't see the corporate like Ambani Adani types will definitely push back against any such possibility. But I think that is in many ways the real battle for many of us who know and understand that the public sector has shrunk in India, even in, say, public schools, right? Like, just if you talk about education alone, you know, outside of the Delhi circuit and maybe some universities in Kolkata, the majority of public institutions in India are struggling for funds. They have no resources. There is no research money. Even JNU right now, yeah, they're squeezing out public education entirely. IITs have some money, I think, but not even there you can see that every year that budget gets slashed. So I think in some ways that the fact that so much is now being pushed on to private education where there is no reservation, you know, Ashoka may have some diversity initiatives. Shivnadar also tries, I think, to have some diversity initiatives and they should have the diversity initiatives. But again, like I said, tomorrow, if they just decide that they don't want to spend that money on, you know, making sure that the students they're getting are from, you know, OBC or Dalit or ST backgrounds, there is nobody to hold them to account. So I think private may reservation is the question to ask right now. In fact, I think that is a pushback I will say. Whereas, and the other thing I will say is, after Rohit Vemula, as much as many Savarnas like to cry about certain things, they don't deny that there is a certain alienation and exclusion of Bahujan people in the educational sector. So I think there is a way in which that discourse can be pushed, you know, in popular culture as well. Because one of the interesting things about the US is even as Asian Americans have become the face of you know, this this current anti-affirmative action movement, the actual statistics suggest that the bulk of the communities don't oppose it. In fact, Indian Americans, actually about 60-65% are actually in favor. And you have to, we have to ask ourselves, how did that cultural shift happen? You know, If at all it was a shift, or how is that actual positive, you know, connotation gained culturally? Through what kind of discourse, through what kind of education? And I think even in India, there is a lot of things people should say and do within their own, you know, social circles and professional circles where we talk about inequality, because everybody knows India is unequal, right? So at this point, I feel like there are so many instances of, you know, these students committing suicides in higher education institutes, bullying like Dr. Payal had faced in, you know, that even in medicine, yes, right?
IIT as well, yeah.
IIT as well, and then you're seeing students commit suicide not getting into universities like Dr. Anita, you know, with NEET and so on. Like, this is happening so often in such dire ways that I think that public discourse around this, and Ambedkarites have done a lot for this, right, to really push that conversation. Whereas 10 years ago, I remember pre-Rohit Vemula, caste was not even talked about. You know, I was teaching in a private college in India, and if I brought up caste in class, everyone will be like, oh, what, that has been solved long ago. Why do we need to talk about it today? So post, you know, 2016, University of Hyderabad, there's really been a shift of sorts. And it's sad that it has to take something like that to make us, you know, stop and pause and try and educate people and all of that. But those moments are there every other year. And I feel like that galvanizing that conversation is very important, and to not let the right wing hijack that conversation, which I think is also the real sort of stress that we have to put on this now, because for them, the most superficial kind of inclusion politics is enough. That's all they need to do. You know, so when we want to say that, make it more meaningful, get more people in here who will be change makers, you know, who can bring the next generation of like professionals and students into public spaces and into public positions, I think that is a huge task for all of us to actually be involved in.
That's true. In fact, वो जो public fund वाली जो बात थी, उससे मुझे JNU का भी recent वो scene याद आ रहा था कि उसकी situation इतनी ज़्यादा ख़राब हो चुकी है infrastructurally JNU की. Like if I was अगर present में, I would never think of going to JNU because it's,
yeah.
वो जो infrastructure. अभी few days back there was एक student के ऊपर छत उसके ऊपर गिर गई. बिकॉज वो पूरा टूट रहा है कैंपस ये, तो लाइक उसके ऊपर गिर गई, उसके पूरे मुंह पे चूना होना और वो सब हो गया. सो द रियल टुकड़े टुकड़े थिंग इज दैट छत का टूटना और ये साथ
में टूट रहे हैं. But this is the kind of, I mean, I really think in India, you know, like affirmative action ka idhar ka, there is a whole question of access. India mein access ka hi ek problem hai, and jab access milta hai, what they get access to is also a problem, right? So it's like we are still at that level. We are not even talking about representation in departments and whether reservation has been effective in this field, that field, whatever. What knowledge gaps exist in each field? That is not a conversation we are having. We are just saying ki in bachchon ko acha hostel do, hostel mein pani rakho, khana milne do. Like, you know, we are at that base level of like get some resources to just live and be able to survive in a campus. That is unfortunately the tragedy, and it is, you know, the successive governments have not, whether state, whether central, whether, you know, local, whatever it is, they have not supported public education in the most vital ways, basic ways. So that is, yeah, the real tragedy here.
So thank you so much, Pallavi, for coming to the podcast. Very grateful that you took out the time and shared your insights and ideas. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this was today's episode. If you like it, then please do contribute on Patreon, Buy Me A Coffee, InstaMojo or PayPal. All the links are mentioned in the description box, so please do make sure to check them. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast.